Unconfirmed sources say this is the best show in the history of sports radio.
You're simply the best.
This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch.
Better than all the rest.
On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Welcome to Writer's Block for Thanksgiving Thursday, if you're listening to us south of the border. Happy Thanksgiving. Hope you're not traveling anywhere because it seems as if everything is a mess right now, travel-wise, down in the States. And the only reason I know that is I know people who are driving to the... Driving to Minnesota right now. Anyhow. Again, happy Thanksgiving if you're listening to us south of the border. If not, thank you for joining us. It is Writer's Block. I'm Jeff Blair. That, as always, is Richard Deitch to my left. It is now Thursday, November 28th. What are we, 72 hours after the Akeem Alou story broke? Yeah, 48-ish, someplace between there.
Yeah, a little less, but you're in the ballpark.
It all runs together. Bill Peters is still technically the head coach of the Calgary Flames, did not coach last night's game, did not accompany the team back to Calgary. Bill Peters did send out a press statement last night, which is several eagle-eyed folks on Twitter remarked, contained coding at the top that suggested it was a legal document, which probably wouldn't surprise a lot of people. It was a clearly, obviously lawyered letter.
Yep.
That didn't apologize directly to Akeem Alou.
Correct.
Did not address, which makes sense, but we'll talk about that in a minute, did not address the allegations of physical abuse when he was with the Carolina Hurricanes, which also makes sense in some ways. And, the thing that made me wonder exactly who his lawyer was the suggestion in the statement that he apologized for using the N-word to the team. Akeem Alou, who has no recollection of that, according to his tweet.
Right.
But claimed that it wasn't directed at anybody.
I'm sorry for laughing.
Was it just directed
to the sky?
I don't know. I don't know how many African American players were on the Rockford Ice Hogs when the statement was made, but I'm reasonably certain that it wasn't directed at a couple of white guys from Quebec. I'm reasonably certain.
I think that's a fair supposition.
That's not the case.
Yeah.
The Flames are continuing their investigation. Essentially, what we're at, the point we're at right now in this whole discussion, seems to be the Flames trying to figure out how they can get out of this contract without having to pay any or much money to Bill Peters. And I think that's kind of where we are. And doing some reading on this, and the leadoff had Daniel Wallach on, a lawyer today, doing some reading on this and exchanging some emails with folks. You know, several things stand out. One of them is technically this did not occur while he was under contract with the Calgary Flames. Doesn't mean it wasn't bad. Doesn't mean, Richard, it's any less egregious. But technically, he was not under contract with the Calgary. So, you know, that's led to the suggestion that part of this investigation, and the NHL is now getting involved, both Akeem Alou and Bill Peters will meet with the NHL, that essentially the NHL, and I presume the Calgary Flames, it seems like they're almost trying to compile a dossier. Did this happen another time? Did we not know about it? Is there a chance that something happened when he was in Calgary? Because we've already seen, Richard, that there seems to be, I don't know if I'd call it a complicit attitude in the NHL towards this, but it certainly appears as if there was no attempt made 10 years ago to really get to the bottom of this.
Oh, yeah, unquestionably on your last statement, Jeff, that would be,
which is,
I think, almost impossible to argue against. It doesn't, I mean, there may be, it seems to be a minimum of due diligence in terms of, like, internally how they handle it. And certainly the larger questions that came up don't seem to be handled at all. The best piece I've seen on this, Jeff, I'm glad the morning show had Daniel Wallach on. I think he's a smart legal analyst. Michael McCann, who's been on this show before, my old Sports Illustrated colleague, is there. I think he's the best out there when it comes to these kind of situations, to sort of put the legal stuff into easy to digest or layman's terms. And what he discussed is he went sort of point by point on how if you are the Flames in the NHL, you approach this. And I think you've hit the sort of where the rubber meets the road here. I think what this has come down to is the Flames trying to figure out a way to pay Bill Peters the least amount of money possible through whatever legal means exists in terms of violating whatever his contract says. What makes it tough in terms of the fact finding, you've brought a couple of these things out. The racial incident happened 10 years ago. So how many cooperating witnesses can you interview? Is there any electronic documents? Are there emails to this effect? Would the Rockford team, which I learned in McCann's piece, now owned by the city, can you get them to release any kind of human resource files? Like, was there an incident reported here? So the Flames, in terms of legally, it is tricky and challenging in terms of, like, trying to acquire all this stuff to make the legal argument. What remains very frustrating to me, Jeff, is that I think with what clearly happened in Rockford, now confirmed by two witnesses and a third, as we mentioned yesterday, who said that they would talk to the NHL and sort of give their witness testimonies. That's essentially three cooperating witnesses. Combine that with what Mikael Jordan said about Bill Peters. What are the Flames waiting for? I guess, you know, waiting for enough of a legal argument to make, but I don't think they're going to. I think at a certain point when there's a preponderance of evidence as to who your coach is, I think organizationally you should make a decision and let the public know who you are. And so at this point, I am certainly after even that Peter statement, which totally contradicts on the record stuff from the report that we saw on TSN. I'm at the point where I think the Calgary Flames should publicly announce that Bill Peters is no longer their coach.
I don't think they can.
Well, they can.
How do, Richard, we talked about this yesterday.
Right.
How can you do that legally? I'm assuming that their first instinct is to get rid of this guy.
Right.
I think
they have cause is what I'm saying.
Well, I don't, okay. Again, to me, I don't know where the stuff that happened in Carolina, how that impacts this. I mean, we've talked about one of the issues being that this incident occurred when he was under contract with another organization. The stuff in Carolina occurred when he was under contract with another organization. Right. I'm not saying Bill Peters isn't a bad guy, but I'm saying if I'm the Calgary Flames, I got to get this right, because if, and again, we don't know what cause is. I haven't seen his contract. I have no idea what cause is. If it's found that he isn't fired, that he's been fired without cause, well, he can turn around and claim that the Flames owe him for subsequent loss of income.
I get it. That will be a very tough case for Bill Peters to win when discovery comes.
I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. I don't know.
I understand what your point is. I get it.
Like, I guess what I'm getting at is...
I'm being a little reactionary.
Well, yeah, because,
I understand.
And people... This is the thing. I know everybody, and Brad Treliving's right about this. Everybody wants an answer.
Yes.
Now, that's not possible. It's just not. I mean, clearly the Flames are operating with legal guidance. I mean, this isn't about Brad Treliving and Bill Peters anymore.
We make that assumption.
This is about lawyers now. We do know it's about lawyers. Yeah, it's about lawyers. I mean, that's where we are.
Yeah.
It's about lawyers. So, it'd be great, but, you know, I don't get upset, because I really don't care one way or another about the Calgary Flames to give a rat's ass. But we should know enough about these things that to rail against a team because they're not doing something that their lawyers told them they shouldn't do.
I get it.
What's the point?
I'm being emotional, and there's a reason why if I was saying this And in the middle of the room, I had lawyers. They would tell me, listen, we understand where you're coming from emotionally. Don't do something stupid.
But it's
here.
Like,
it's frustrating.
It's false, but it's false outrage.
False outrage, Jeff.
Let the process finish.
And I don't love outrage. I think it's such an overused cliche, but you could be ticked off at the process.
Yeah, but
legitimately, and also understand your point that the legal process has to take place in order for the organization not to be put in a terribly bad financial position.
That's like being pissed off at the weather.
This isn't the weather, though, man.
It's like being pissed off at the weather. You can't do anything about it.
I understand. And that is where, that to me is where the frustration is, because let's be honest here. You don't tell me it's raining when it's sunny. Everybody knows what this guy did. Everybody, I think, can see that statement that he released is total BS, and you just want a resolution. But I get what you're saying.
You don't know what he did. He stated...
I have three witnesses also, on the record.
He's also stated now on the record that he apologized to the team. He stated that on the record in his apology.
Haven't heard that confirmed.
No, but don't you want to find out if it was confirmed or not?
Does that change the fact?
Don't you want to find out how much, if there's anything else here?
Would an apology after the fact change the fact for you?
It would for Hakeem Olu. He said if there'd been an apology, he wouldn't have said this.
Right.
My point is, I want to find out if there's more stuff about this guy. And the only way you're going to do that, I mean, once Bill Peters is fired by the Flames and out of work, we're not going to know anything else. I want to find out. I'm interested now, as I said yesterday, knowing who knew what when. I want to know what Ron Francis knew. Yeah. I want to know what the Chicago Blackhawks knew. I can't find that out. I can't find that out if Bill Peters is summarily dismissed.
Unless the NHL decides to.
No reason to do it. There's no reason for the NHL. Once Bill Peters is dismissed, the driving reason for investigating disappears.
I am self-aware to understand that I am reacting, one, emotionally, and two, as a reactionary. I am way self-aware under that. At the same time, it's just frustrating. It is frustrating to not see some kind of adjudication by, at least in my opinion now, what feels like overwhelming evidence.
They've removed him from the team. He's not with the team. He's not coaching. Short of firing him, I don't know what else the Flames could do.
Yeah, okay. I mean, listen, I can't, because I don't know the actual contract, because I don't know the language of the contract, my argument sort of has an ending, because if I was in management, and it's very easy for me as a talk show host in Toronto to just scream, but if I was in Calgary management, depending on the language of that contract, I would have to react accordingly in terms of, can I provide, I understand this, do I have whatever the cause is, so that if I release this employee with said cause, I'm going to be in a good position where I'm not going to end up being countersued for X money. I will say this, Jeff, and again, I realize this is totally me saying this, and I'm not the one giving out the money. It's not my money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, it really is only money. And if, like, they lost it, they lost it. You know, you're doing a right, I think, by changing the coach, and it's only money in the end. And if that's really what we're fighting about, that's what we're fighting about, is just how much to pay this guy, and did he violate the terms of his contract, and can we remove him and get a new coach without paying anything? That's what
to me, when you do that, you're making it easy for people to sweep stuff under the carpet.
No, and I don't want to. I was just going to get to your point, which I think is the right point. You want to know, like, what did Francis know? How much of this is an issue just institutionally?
Hockey people would like him to be fired right now so that we can go back to talking about the Leafs' third line.
By the way, that's not how I feel.
No, but I'm saying hockey people want him fired right now so we can drop this. I think smart people want to see where this goes.
It's a good take.
The betterment of the game, firing Bill Peters isn't going to better the NHL.
No, not at all.
It's justified. Don't get me wrong. It's not going to better the NHL. Yeah. I think the more this is out there, the more we get a chance to find out. And this is what frustrates me about this, is at no point on any station have I heard anybody else say, why aren't we talking about what the Blackhawks knew or didn't know? Just 10 years ago when he was with a different organization. We're fixated on that one incident, which is right, but it's like nobody wants to kind of take that to the next step. Now we're fixated on the Carolina incident. But I want to know who with the Chicago Blackhawks knew about this.
Yeah.
I want to know where they are now.
Yeah.
Because that to me, Bill Peters to me is irrelevant at this point in time. What I'm interested now is, because we've started to have this discussion about the culture of hockey, where did this go? Was it handled? Why wasn't it handled? And if it wasn't handled properly, who was the reason behind that? Very interesting, I thought. Peter Karamanos, the owner of the Carolina Hurricanes, quoted today as saying, had he known about Bill Peters physically abusing players, this is when he owned the Hurricanes, he doesn't own them anymore, he would not have agreed to a contract extension. And he said, I have put a call into Ron Francis. I want to hear from them,
usually,
from him.
And that's how, like, that kind of pressure is usually how you may get Ron Francis to talk.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I agree. And that's what I want to hear.
No, these are good thoughts. And the Blackhawks one is institutionally, like you, I want to know when Akeem Olu went to management, from that second, what happened? What were the processes in place? Who knew about this? And is there a file? Was it handled institutionally as was it handled via HR, as these organizations are in theory supposed to do? But, you know, we see this throughout corporations and throughout society and throughout entertainment, that a lot of this stuff gets swept under the rug to continue whatever the sort of the power structure is in these institutions. So I do hope these questions need to be continued to be asked. They usually and often are asked by the media. And hopefully in this case, they will still continue to be. And Ron Francis has to talk.
Yeah, at some point.
Because Ron Francis has now.
Coach of the Carolina Hurricanes saying that when he worked with this guy, this happened.
If you are the public face of an NHL team, as Ron Francis is in Seattle, I would argue that that you have a significant responsibility to address this stuff.
Yep.
If you're a serious person, if you care about this stuff, and
I agree completely.
We'll see.
I agree completely. There's going to be a whole lot of lawyers making a whole lot of money out of this.
On this one. I will say one last one, and this was from the McCann piece, Jeff, that Gary Bettman does have a lot of jurisdiction here to come in with an investigation, as well as to make a larger statement about adjudication in terms of who could be, it's a lack of a better word, but who can be punished for this, including, by the way, people who are in the game who were involved in Rockford 10 years ago. So that's another one where I think we'll see how serious the NHL is about this down the road.
Yeah, and that gets to my point that the easiest way to ensure a proper investigation is done is to keep it. To keep aspects of it.
Yeah, I might have been too reactionary. I'm sort of coming around. I understand where you're coming from.
I understand.
Your point is the long game, and the long game ultimately is how institutions change.
Yeah, because, we've been talking about the change in hockey culture for years. And, it goes back to Graham James and, Sheldon Kennedy and Theo Fleury and the torture they were put through and the things they were put through and the way their lives and their careers were ruined and impacted.
And those are the ones we know about.
But that's the thing. This is, we've been talking culture change in the NHL and how the NHL and hockey needs to be a safer work environment for about 25 years. We really have. We've had inclusion, and this predates Gary Bettman. We've had all these good intentions, all these broad statements, and we find out that stuff may not have changed as much as we wanted to. The only way that happens is to kind of keep the pressure on here. It is Thanksgiving Thursday in the United States. That, of course, means NFL football. John Clayton, the professor, will join us at 3 o'clock. Gord Stellick, our Leafs Nation pre- and post-game analyst, will be along. The Leafs beat the Red Wings 6-0 last night. If ever there was a game that was that is the definition of a laugher, it was that game. Gord Stellick joins us. Nick Nurse, head coach of the Toronto Raptors, speaking of laughers, the Raptors beat the Knicks 126-98 yesterday. Their next game is against the Orlando Magic. Ren Lavoie as well. Shai Davidi, an article in Sportsnet we mentioned yesterday as we went off the air. Kyle Gibson signed by the Texas Rangers. That, by my count, is now two pitchers the Jays have sort of sent out smoke signals about having an interest in. Jake Odorizzi decided to take the contract offer from the Minnesota Twins. Nothing he can do about that. Kyle Gibson signing a three-year, $30 million contract with the Texas Rangers. I'm hoping the Jays made an offer somewhere in the neighborhood of that to Kyle. If they're losing Kyle Gibson to the Texas Rangers at 3-30, yeah. I got no faith that they're going to sign anybody this year. So we'll talk to Shai about that. But when we come back, Ken Fidlin is the former Toronto Sun baseball writer. He is the winner of this year's Jack Graney Award given out by the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. Ken Fidlin will join us. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Well, I once believed all girls are nice, but girls listen to me.
A reminder that it's the final day of our Champions of Rec League Cup contest brought to you by the Beer Store. Today, you can vote to determine which two of the three remaining teams, that's Ice Cold, the Oshawa North Stars, and the Trash Pandas, will play in the first annual Champions of Rec League Cup game, which will be called by Joe Bowen and Jim Ralph, live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan on January 5th. This, of course, is the game that will be played at the Mattamy Athletic Center. Voting closes on Twitter, that's Fan590, at midnight tonight. Tomorrow, we'll announce the two winning teams who will compete for the Champions of Rec League Cup title. For more information, go to sportsnet.ca/CORL. A reminder, this contest is open to Ontario residents only. Every year, the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame gives out the Jack Graney Award, which is presented annually to a media member who has made significant contributions to baseball in Canada through their life's work. This year's recipient is Ken Fidlin, former baseball columnist at the Toronto Sun, who retired in 2016 after more than 45 years as a sports writer. I was lucky enough to work alongside Ken. I was lucky enough to travel with Ken and enjoy several beverages at Irish pubs along the way. Ken was I told someone this yesterday when we were talking about it. I said, Ken was the model of the measured reporter, measured writer who had an ability to get to the bottom of a story without needing to go through a lot of the drama that a lot of us go through when we try to get to the bottom of the story. Ken Fidlin joining Richard Deitch and myself in Writer's Block. Ken, thanks so much for doing this today. Hearty congratulations on this award, man. It's really well deserved.
Well, thanks very much. Little introduction you gave to me is you've got to start taking your angry pills again, Jeff. I mean, you're way too soft on the air now.
No.
Give it a couple minutes, Ken.
It won't happen. I mean, I think you know how seriously I mean this. I mean, Ken, what does that, you know, what does the award mean to you?
I think it's, as you said, I was kind of a measured type of writer, and I think what I brought to my workplace every day was a consistent level of attempt and try, and tried, as you said, try to get to the bottom of a story. That's kind of where I was.
Ken, tell us a bit about your background. Tell our listeners a bit about your background. I know you were in Ottawa before you came here, but just tell us a bit about your personal history, your journey to the Toronto Sun.
Well, I was born in a little town called Norwich and grew up there. It's about 20 miles south of Woodstock, Ontario. I went to Western, flunked out after my third year, and just started working in construction. And a buddy of mine was the sports editor at the Woodstock Sentinel Review, and he decided to go back to school in the fall. So he said, why don't you give this a shot? And I said, I had no idea about it. I was vaguely interested in journalism, but I had no training and no official training. And I went for the interview, and I got offered the job that afternoon. I think it was because I was willing to take the paltry salary that they were offering me.
Yeah, I think that's how we all started.
I stayed a year there. I stayed a year in Woodstock, and I went to Kingston. That's where I hooked up with Bob Elliott, and we've been colleagues for 35 years, I guess, since then. But I worked there for another year, and then we moved to Ottawa, both Bob and I, at pretty much the same time. And then when the Journal folded in 1980, George Gross asked me to come down to the Toronto Sun.
Ken, you mentioned, or Jeff mentioned at the top, that your sort of hallmark or your trademark was measuredness, consistency. Throughout your personal and professional journey, you've watched baseball writing, baseball coverage change probably dramatically many times. Where do you see it right now, especially in relation to a writer as yourself who sort of approached things on a measured term, as opposed to outrage or as opposed to like maybe attention-getting kind of columns?
Well, I think the whole dynamic of the baseball industry has changed dramatically. Back in the when I started covering baseball in the 80s, the ballplayers didn't make all that much more money than we did. I mean, there were some that were in the high income bracket, but we were more equals, and there was a lot more camaraderie. A little bit of, I mean, there was always some tension because you have to tell the story as it is. But I think in today's world, each player is pretty much their own little corporate entity, and it's we're far, far removed from them as people. We used to be kind of colleagues in a way, and they're not. It's not that way anymore at all. So there's a lot more antagonism, I think.
Ken, who was your favorite personality to cover?
Well, it's funny. I think my favorite players. My favorite player was Mark Burley because he got so much, especially at the stage he was at when he came to Toronto. He was getting by on an 80-mile-an-hour fastball and a little dinky 65-mile-an-hour curveball, and you'd see these guys go up to the plate, and then they'd be muttering away as they went back to the dugout. It was remarkable to watch. I think the other guy I thought of was Mark DeRosa.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't that great a ball player, but boy, did he know how to work a clubhouse.
Yes, he did.
I mean, he was such a great team guy. Whenever there was something that needed to be said, both negatively and positively, he was the guy to say it, and more eloquently than almost any ball player I've ever been around.
Ken, how interesting do you find the game today?
Not as much. You know, it's funny. I was shocked how quickly you can go from being totally immersed to become totally out of touch with the game. You know, I walked out of the Rogers Center after that last playoff game in 2016, and it just seemed like I walked far away from the game really quite immediately. I went back down for a visit at spring training, and just felt like a fifth wheel wandering around the complex. So it's an interesting dynamic. I mean, I guess it's just so much of your life is involved in staying in touch with every aspect of the team that you're covering, that it's no longer necessary. It really changes.
Hey, Ken, listen, we really appreciate you joining us today. Again, congratulations. All the best, and we'll see you at St. Mary's at the ceremony. Looking forward to it. Oh. Thanks, man.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Ken Fidlin is the winner of the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame's Jack Graney Award. As I said, I used to marvel at sitting beside Ken in a press box. And Brunt and Michael Farber were the same way. They were the same guys at 3 in the afternoon. They were 3 minutes before deadline. You could look over at him. Not a difference. And Brunt would get up, 5 minutes before a deadline and go get some coffee and come back and sit down. Ken was very much the same way.
Yeah, Michael Farber is, and I worked with him for many years. He's the best I've ever seen, Jeff, at the combination of quality of writing and speed of that quality.
Yep.
I've never seen anybody like it.
The Toronto Blue Jays look, Kyle Gibson was alleged to be one of their free agent pitching targets this offseason. It would certainly make sense. He would seem to be in their wheelhouse in terms of what they were looking for, what they can reasonably get. They're not signing Garrett Cole. He's kind of the level below that. Kyle Gibson has ended up signing with the Texas Rangers 3 years and $30 million, which seems to me to be a contract the Jays should consider offering a guy. Now, he's a free agent. Doesn't necessarily have to sign, obviously, with Toronto. And as we've mentioned all the time, when you're dealing with Texas, their income tax considerations here in Texas compared to Ontario. Shai Davides, our MLB insider at Sportsnet, he wrote today, I thought, a real timely piece. Shai, thanks for joining Richard and myself. Jake Odorizzi takes the Minnesota Twins contract offer. There's not much you can do about that. But Shai, if you're getting outbid for Kyle Gibson, that doesn't necessarily augur well for your offseason.
Well, I mean, certainly it's a guy that they wanted. I mean, they wanted Jake Odorizzi too, and in that case, his camp decided that the qualifying offer made sense. Made more sense than anything out there that he was being offered. And with Kyle Gibson, my guess is that the difference wasn't financial in him not taking the Blue Jays offer. I think there could have been, a desire to be in Texas or something along those lines, which sometimes a team can't control. But I can't imagine that for the contract that he signed, that the Blue Jays wouldn't have been outbid for that financially. So it is difficult for them, though, because it's somebody that they like, and it's somebody who made sense for them because it's a decent number for a guy who could have outperformed that contract quite easily based on some of his underlying peripherals. Now two of the guys that were, of some priority on their list. I don't know exactly where on their list, but two guys that they'd wanted and hoped to get are now off the board, and it's time for them to pivot.
Shai, where should Blue Jays fans' confidence be, or confidence level be, regarding the front office spending on pitching?
I think that at this point we have to wait to see where they end up, right? And if it ends up being, a few roll of the dice guys, and there isn't a lot of certainty or stability added to the rotation, and ideally you wanted a piece, you want at least one, if not two pieces, who can be contributors when the team's actually good, guys that are really going to have to be forced out of the rotation by the kids, as opposed to guys that are just placeholders until the kids are ready, and so. Well, there's still a lot of offseason. There's still a lot of pitchers out there. The Blue Jays still have resources and financial flexibility at their disposal. But we'll have to see. I mean, I think Odorizzi, they certainly would have had the chance to. And my guess is that financially that they couldn't see eye to eye with him and what it would have taken to buy him out of the qualifying offer. With Gibson, it might have been circumstantial, which is out of their control. So, it's unfortunate right now. Those two guys would have been Either one of those two guys would have been really good stabilizing ads for this team, would have shown a degree of seriousness to what they're doing, would have given them some credibility in the market, not only locally, but in terms of talking to other free agents. But there's still a ton of offseason left. And, you know, really, it's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of who's signed and what's happened.
You know, Shai, here's my concern about this. I mean, we've covered this team enough to know that the only way you're ever going to sign a free agent here is to overpay or overterm, whatever, however you want to describe it. I always tell people, Russ Martin, Canada's own, they had to overpay to get him here. And it's as simple as that. This front office is so analytically inclined. Do you think they have the stones to overpay somebody to get them in here?
I mean, that's really going to be the test, and they're going to have to if they're going to get somebody, right? Because you're as a team in the midst of a rebuild that's relying essentially on guys barely out of their teenagers to pan out. You know, that's not the city is great. The city's not a problem, but from a competitive standpoint, it's not a prime situation. And you're trying to rebuild in the American League East, where the Yankees are amazing, the Tampa Bay Rays are really, really good, and the Boston Red Sox, even though are in flux, have an insanely deep roster too. So, you know, it's a pretty tough sell. The only way you're going to get there, you're going to get somebody to come there, is to pay them more than you want to. And, you know, even when the Blue Jays were competitive, they had to give Kendrys Morales a year more than other teams were willing to give them. And that was for Kendrys Morales. Hmm. And so in a competitive pitching market, that's the reality. Do they have the stones, as you put it, or whatever? I mean, ultimately, they're going to have to. Unless they're going to trade completely from their farm system, which I don't believe they're going to do. They may make a deal from their farm system, but they can't do it all from their farm system. And so at some point, they're going to have to make some sort of agreement that they're not comfortable with. And the question becomes, you know, do you want the big overspend for a guy you really like? Or is it a smaller overspend for, you know, a lower to middle tier kind of guy who you're hoping to get right the way they did with Jay Happ in 2016?
Shai, where do things stand contractually on both sides regarding Matt Shoemaker?
So he is arbitration eligible, and the Blue Jays have to give him tender him an offer by the deadline on Monday. And I think both sides want to get something done outside of a hearing room, because his is it's a unique case, because he's missed lots of time with injuries the past few years, but he's still within the time that he was pitching has put up some numbers and has some good background. So it's a bit of a volatile case in terms of the comps that you can make with it. And so I think my guess is that they're going to get something done. I've thought all along they were going to get something done. I think the fact that they didn't get either Gibson or Odorizzi has probably made it a bit more likely that they get something done with Shoemaker. But it seems that both sides need the deadline to get there. And so expect something to happen on Monday.
Shai, great of you to join us, man. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem, fellas. Take care.
Thanks, Shai.
Shai Davidi, our MLB insider with Sportsnet. You can read Shai's article on sportsnet.ca right now. We will take a break, come back, get you set for the 3 o'clock hour. John Clayton, Gord Stellick ahead. Nick Nurse, head coach of the Toronto Raptors as well. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Do the very best you can with what you have. Do the very best you can with what you have.
Barry Gordy turned 90 today. Founder of Motown Records. Hence, we are playing some of Derek Brandeo's Motown favorites. If you're listening on the radio. John Clayton joins us at 3 o'clock. Of course, it is Thanksgiving Thursday in the NFL. You call the Bears and Lions an appetizer?
Not a good one. But, yeah, I mean, the Lions are...
They stink.
So historically one of the early games
right
for Thanksgiving. And
why wouldn't they put a college game on instead of the Bears and the Lions?
Well, the NCAA and the NFL are different entities. I mean, we talked about this with Nance yesterday. I don't understand. I shouldn't say I don't understand. That's not true. So much of sports changes, Jeff, that mm-hmm. the time to rotate these teams, I feel like, is upon us. I understand there's a history and a tradition, but, like, at a certain point, the lines have been so bad for so long.
You think,
like,
America can do, would America survive not having its Lions?
Yeah, I think
Lions
so. Yeah.
Served to them at 1 o'clock on Thanksgiving.
Served is nice. You'd have a lot of Detroit fans pissed off, but whatever.
There's like four of them.
Yeah. I mean, at a certain point, like the professional sports are very, very good at making the, like, holiday games, like, really, really mm-hmm. great. Like, Lakers and Clippers are playing Christmas Day.
Yeah, Christmas Day NBA that, games are, you know, always the gussied up and fun.
For the NHL, they play the, what's the New Year's Day game?
The outdoor game.
Outdoor
classic,
game. Oh, yeah, it's always great. So I don't understand why the NFL would not basically make, like, Thanksgiving sort of the mega matchups, but instead they're just beholden to the Lions. The Cowboys, I get, though. The Cowboys are the most popular team in the league. Most polarizing team in the league.
I have no problem sticking sticking the best teams in the league.
I think it'd be fun
during Thanksgiving.
It'd be like a fun, like, Thanksgiving.
I think it'd be great if you did that.
Yeah.
You know, and I understand. Look, you can't always predict who the best team is.
That's the issue.
But yeah. You can be reasonably certain that between the Bears and the Lions, one of them is going to suck big time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's almost like paying taxes.
Yeah. Like this year, if nothing else, you kind of knew that the Patriots, the Chiefs, the Saints. The Rams haven't been as good, but I mean, there's like five teams that you got to feel are going to be great.
Yeah, and stick the Eagles on.
Yeah, I would have, although they're not having a good
year.
I'd like to see two of the, at least if you're going to go the three-game route, I think two of those games should be mega matchups.
Absolutely.
And the later would better because Americans mostly eat early. But yeah, on the one hand, it's cool that I guess you got the NFL on a Thursday. On the other hand, like, you know, we have the Lions-Bears game in the background. It's interminable. It's just not very good football.
Yeah. The second game is the one a lot of people will be waiting for.
Yeah.
It's probably two teams, I would imagine, the Bills and the Cowboys, probably sick of hearing that they haven't beaten anybody.
The Cowboys are in a little bit of a, you know, if the Bills end up losing, they're not going to be happy, but they're still 8-4.
Right.
They're going to make the playoffs.
Right.
But the Cowboys are in a really interesting situation because their owner is chirping about they have to win. There's a lot of pressure, more pressure than ever on Jason Garrett.
Mm-hmm.
Dak Prescott still hasn't signed his big contract. Like, this is for the Cowboys, I wouldn't call it a crisis because the Cowboys are like almost always in crisis. But this is, if they lose, pretty monster story in the NFL because I think the voices to get rid of Jason Garrett get really, really loud. Jerry Jones is an owner who likes the sound of his voice very much, likes to be in the public front. That could get real interesting quick. I would expect the Cowboys to win.
I was going to say, which franchise needs to fire it? Which NFL franchises need to fire their owners? Washington, obviously.
I'd love to see. I think Daniel Snyder is one of the. He's in the top five of worst owners.
I always think Jerry Jones is an impediment to this team now.
Yeah, I don't particularly love Jerry Jones, but I have to admire the fact that, one, he's very, very savvy and smart when it comes to the media and getting as much money as he has that way. And the other thing is he is a football guy.
He's played at Arkansas.
Some of these guys are just sort of rich dudes who love the fact that they own a team. And I'll be honest with you, I mean, I'll sort of give something away here, but Stephen Ross is now in my bottom five of owners given his... I support civil rights. I support people of color. But, yeah, I'm going to host a fundraiser for Donald Trump. It's interesting, though. The NFL is always interesting because it's always a crisis somewhere.
John Clayton is hosting 710 ESPN Seattle. He is the professor. School's in. The professor's next. It's Writer's Block on 590 and 360.
They're not afraid to put their name on it. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
There are three games in the NFL sched today. Thanksgiving. The game that is currently enthralling America is a 17-17 tie between the Bears and the Lions. Cowboys and Bills, that's the next game. And then tonight, New Orleans and the team formerly known as the Atlanta Falcons. Be some points scored in that game, I think. Yeah, Writer's Block with Blair and Deitch. John Clayton is a host on 710 ESPN Seattle. He was one of the original NFL insiders. One of the original.
Will McDonough is like the first. And then Clayton is part of the second wave.
But
one of the preeminent second wave dudes.
Thank you.
Yes.
He is also host of the Schooled with the Professor podcast. You can follow him at John Clayton NFL. And we're very pleased to be joined on Writer's Block for his weekly appearance by John Clayton. Mr. Clayton, thank you so much for joining us. Happy Thanksgiving to you and yours.
Thank you.
Richard and I were talking before the break about the Bills-Cowboys game, which understandably will have a lot of focus in this area. And I was just saying to Richard, I kind of get the sense these are two teams. At the end of tonight, one of them is going to be able to say, we've actually beaten somebody this year, because they've got to be sick of hearing that you guys haven't beaten anybody this year.
Oh, absolutely. But that's a reality. I mean, the Bills have only beaten one team that currently has a winning record. That's Tennessee. And when they played Tennessee, the Titans had a losing record. Mm. And here's the Cowboys 0-4 against winning teams. And that's going to be one that I think it continues to be an issue. But that's a reality. And that's the thing with when you only have 16 teams with winning records in the league and you have a lot of teams that are really horrible. I mean, the Bills are a classic example of taking advantage of an easy schedule. And, you know, you can't complain about the schedule, but also, too, when you play the winning teams, you at least need to come up with a .500 record. Mm-hmm. And, you know, right now, I mean, the Bills, I guess you could say, have done a little bit of a better job because Tennessee at least now has a winning record, but the Cowboys haven't.
John, one of the subplots, if you will, one of the subtexts of today's Bills-Cowboys game is the status of Jason Garrett. And there's been a lot of noise, a lot of loud noise in Dallas this week about his job status. What would a loss today mean, if it means anything?
Well, if it's a bad special teams play, I have to think that the special teams coach is gone, because as much as Jerry Jones has been complaining about the coaching, he's been very specific about the special teams. So I think you can see a change there. I don't envision any change as far as the head coach now, but I think you can anticipate something maybe after the season. And the reason is, when Jerry's still likes to keep his coaches, but he also likes to keep the coach for the whole year, unless there's somebody on the staff that he feels he's ready to promote. And I don't know what he feels about Chris Richard, the defensive back, defensive coordinator type of guy. Don't know if that would be one that he would consider. I think Kellen Moore is a little bit too young. So if there's nobody currently on the staff that he wants to promote, then I think he stays with Jason. But if Jason doesn't not only make the playoff, but win a playoff game or two, I think he's in trouble.
John, we've talked a lot with you about the Bills. We haven't really talked much about the Cowboys, but from your perspective, what are the Cowboys? Are the Cowboys a legitimate playoff team with Super Bowl aspirations, or are they right now a bit of a pretender?
No, I think when you look at the fact they've had 15 players on their roster that have been to the Pro Bowl, and you look at some of the good young players that they've drafted, particularly on defense the last couple of years, you see that that's a talented team. And then you look at Dak Prescott. Right now he runs the number one offense and throwing over 300 yards a game. They have one of the best running backs in football in Ezekiel Elliott. They've got an offensive line that I think many consider to be the best. And what's I guess, gone wrong is that they just haven't achieved what the talent level is. Because when you look at the slow starts, that's probably attributed to Jason Garrett. The fact that they've lost some close games, that's probably on Jason. And so there's a lot of pressure on him because, again, the talent's there to be a Super Bowl contender.
What explains Dallas's issues against the run? And I would think particularly in this game with both Josh Allen and Devin Singletary that you're probably going to see the Bills try to run the ball, the Cowboys. What explains their issues with the run?
I haven't studied it closely, but my guess would be they probably, like every team in the league, have had some matchups against running quarterbacks. And running quarterbacks are really, causing good defenses to be average defenses because you can't stop the run. And here's Josh Allen, one of the better running quarterbacks in the league, and that'll cause them problems. Because, what do you do? I mean, particularly, like, for example, when you're looking at Lamar Jackson, I mean, nobody's been able to figure out what to do. Do you go man? Because when you go man, then, of course, that gives him the ability to know that the defensive backs are going to be not looking at him, and if he can slip past the guy who's going to be maybe the spy, then he's going to gain
gain yards. That's problem number one. So, like, for example, more teams are using zone. But I think right now there's an adjustment period going on because now you have a good group of running quarterbacks, and it's causing problems. And so if you have a couple matchups where you're going against running quarterbacks, you're going to have problems.
John, I read your piece in the Washington Post. You're welcome for the click. And one of the things that I found interesting was your examination of the Browns. The Browns have fascinated me since the preseason, and I'm probably not alone in this, and where they had a very, very tough schedule and probably underperformed early. The rest of their schedule is just sitting for a potential back into the playoffs. And I feel like this week is key because if you can get through this week, as you write, two games against the winless Bengals plus one game against a three-win Cardinals team. So as crazy a season as they've had, John, it's not impossible for them to make the playoffs.
No, I mean, I still think it's going to be tough because they've got the six losses. But, you know, if the bar is going to be set at nine, and again, that's why I think Buffalo's in such good shape because they've already got the eight, and so they should be able to get to 10. But if the bar is going to be set at nine, they do have a shot to maybe be able to get in there. Because when you look at it, I mean, after Pittsburgh, I mean, Baltimore's the only team that they have to play with a winning record. So, you know, if they can be better than these teams, you know, then they can get to eight and maybe nine. So well, you figure there's going to be one more loss. But really, when you look at this game coming up this weekend, probably the loser of it is going to be in a tough spot.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Pittsburgh would be at 6-6, Cleveland will be at 6-6, and Cleveland would have the edge when the tiebreaker over Pittsburgh. So this is kind of an elimination type of game, but it's also one that the Browns can maybe come up and maybe salvage a good season.
How do you think the Myles Garrett, Mason Rudolph situation, which hangs over this game, could manifest itself this weekend in this
it's going to be a problem. I guess the bigger problem would be if Myles Garrett were playing in this game.
Right.
That's one that I think that would even be tougher because then you've got a lot more action. But you know, I think that's why the league moved it from a 4:25 Eastern start to 1 o'clock start, because you know, you don't want to have that extra 3 hours of beverages that'll be going on between, you know, the Browns fans and the Steeler fans. So they moved it up. And I think also to try to hide it a little bit, but of course, I mean, everybody's going to be watching it because it's such an interesting game. But no, there's going to be a lingering effect. And I mean, if you go back, and I used to cover the Steelers and I know that division real well, the fans are really into it. Mm-hmm. And now they're going to be more into it because of the Myles Garrett thing. So I think it could be an ugly game from that regard. I'm sure that the officials who are going to be there have already warned the coaches and will warn the players that it's like, hey, we're not going to handle too many fights here. So you better watch out and behave.
John, as we're watching the Bears-Lions game right now, so much of the conversation with the Bears is about Mitchell Trubisky. Is there time still for him to, I don't know, win over his organization and fan base? Or are we, for lack of a really bad, better phrase, are we looking at a dead quarterback walking and eventually the successor is somewhere else?
Yeah, I think we're starting to look at a dead quarterback walking, although, you know, they're playing the Lions, and the Lions have a pretty good history this year and with Matt Patricia of losing close games.
Right.
What they've had the lead in about 9 or 10 of these games, and they've lost them. And so this is one where, you know, this could help the Mitch Trubisky front, but I think you can see he's making the mistakes. I mean, the interception to Darius Slay, where he was a little bit behind in the throw, to Allen Robinson, that's on him. The fact that he ran for a first down and then he doubles back, and you saw how furious that the coach was, Matt Nagy, when he, you know, gave back the first down and now put him in a field goal position. So in the end, I think that he's still making bad decisions. And because of that, you know, I think they're not going to like cut him next year. But my guess is they bring in another quarterback, whether it's Teddy Bridgewater or somebody else, to compete and maybe beat him out.
So Lamar Jackson has quarterback teams to wins of more than 34 points in back-to-back games, teams with winning records. He takes on the 49ers. That to me is the marquee matchup, I think, this weekend. What can the 49ers do against Lamar? And if the 49ers can't contain Lamar Jackson, should we just, you know, run up the white flag?
Yeah, well, I mean, somebody's got to figure something out at some point, or somebody's got to get a hit on him to slow him down, but nobody's been able to do it. And I think you can see that the 49ers, despite being one of the best defenses in football and having maybe the best defensive line, are still going to have some trouble because look what's happened to them in their last four of the last five games, where it's like they faced running quarterbacks, Kyler Murray twice, gave up a lot of points and a lot of yards. They lost to Russell Wilson of the Seahawks, and now here's Lamar, the best running back quarterback who maybe has ever come into the league, and he's been unstoppable so far. So nobody's been able to figure out what to do, and if they can figure it out, good for them, but I think this is going to be tough.
You know, you mentioned Kyler Murray, and it's a guy that intrigued me as a baseball guy, of course, the whole story of him being drafted and choosing the NFL, very small guy. What's your read in his year, and what do you think has to happen for him to take the next step forward?
I think he's already taken a step. I think he's that good.
Mm-hmm.
Because look at the points, look at the yards and all those different things. I mean, the problem's not on his front. The problem is more on the defensive front, because you got a defense that gives up way too many points. And so it's almost like he has to get 28 points a game to be able to get victories. I mean, you can see he can move the ball. He's getting better each week. They're trying different type of things with their offensive game plan. I mean, they started the season with a five receiver look, and then they were still weak at the receiver position. So then they changed over and they went to a three receiver set. Now they're using a little bit more two tight ends with the three receiver set. But I think that you can see that he's very effective. He's more accurate than I think people thought. And I think he's well ahead of the game right now.
John, I want to go back quickly just to Lamar Jackson for a second. Now that we have obviously a little bit of runway and we see just how incredible a player he is, any findings from you as to how a guy that talented drops that far in the first round?
I think it's probably the old school nature of the National Football League, because thinking that the player has to be more pro-oriented than college-oriented. And, I mean, you saw it back in 2012 where you have two rounds of teams passing on Russell Wilson.
Yep.
Only because he's 5'10 and 5'8". Okay, so now Russell opens the door, and Kyler Murray goes at the top of the draft. Baker Mayfield goes at the top of the draft. They get educated in that front. Now it's a matter of the running quarterback, particularly in his college career where he doesn't show accuracy. Everybody gets a little bit afraid of that. Now I think the door is going to be open, thanks to Lamar, for more running quarterbacks to do well. Because, I mean, really, when you go back to even 2018, Josh Allen, he had the bad rap because he got the great arm, but he also didn't have great accuracy. Well, now you can see, say what you want, he may not be great, but he's 8-3.
Yeah.
And so, everybody's looking for the pocket passing guy, but now I think thanks to Lamar and thanks to Russell Wilson, you're looking for maybe the shorter guy who can hold up and the running quarterback who can eventually be more accurate.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting you say that, because I think one of the things we've seen this year with those three players is I think there was a tendency with RG3, the way that kind of caved in on the Redskins, to sort of say, okay, that's an experiment that didn't work. But you're starting to see teams understand that you can win with the running quarterback, but you can't just sort of throw the running quarterback out there by himself. You've got to structure your offense a little bit to give him some help.
Exactly. I mean, if you go back to RG3's year as a rookie, I mean, he went to the Pro Bowl. Or he didn't go to the Pro Bowl. He was voted to go to the Pro Bowl. He got the knee injury in the Seattle playoff game. And he was good. I mean, he came in and did exactly what you would want a quarterback to do as a rookie. Get your team to the playoffs. And he did. Unfortunately, they ran him a little bit too much, particularly on that bad field that they had.
Mm-hmm.
And Pop goes the ACL, and Pop goes pretty much, his chances of maybe being a great quarterback.
John, it's great of you to join us. Thanks so much. And again, happy Thanksgiving. Should be a fun weekend.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks, John.
Take care. John Clayton, host NFL Insider at 710 ESPN Seattle and the Schooled with the Professor podcast. Follow him on Twitter, John Clayton NFL.
He's based in Seattle, so he's got a front row seat to a really good team.
It is kind of fascinating, though, how when I think back, our friend Dave Shinen wrote a book on RG3, and you think back to just how sensational he was.
People got
scared all of a sudden.
But you remember how big, like, it was a phenomenon. Like, the whole country was like, sort of enamored with him.
What bowl game was that where he had the outrageous, he had like 500 and some yards passing.
It was Baylor beating some top five team.
58-48 or something.
I mean, that first year you were like, all right, this is like Michael Vick 2.0.
Yes.
This guy's unbelievable. He's going to be the greatest quarterback ever. And then in typical Redskin fashion, you're right. They ran him, and then you started seeing him just getting pounded.
Yeah.
And it turned really, really quickly. He didn't have the best relationship with the Washington press. I think I don't know, Jeff, if you remember this, but it got to like the lunacy of like idiot sports television yappers in the States, like questioning how black the guy was.
I mean, I remember that.
It was an absolute mess with that guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but boy, as John said, you look around the NFL now and the running quarterbacks are having success.
Totally, yeah.
If you look at the 49ers in particular, They're allowing fewer passing yards per game than any team since 1980. If Lamar Jackson shreds them, he might as well just, like I said, just run up the white flag.
I'll tell you, man, that you know, the Ravens as a franchise are probably historically underrated. They've been good for a long time with different, you know, from
different
Flacco
styles. Could
to,
you go, could you pick a different
Lamar
quarterback?
Jackson. I know, but they're,
I know.
You know what they, and then they won with that incredible defense and a garbage quarterback, basically.
No, I think you're right. I think people kind of view them as sort of an accident almost.
But they're not. It's a great point. But at this point, shouldn't they be thought of in the pantheon of these great franchises that are always winning?
They should be put in the pantheon of the not as good as the Patriots, but not embarrassing
they
themselves.
Need another, you know what it is? They need another Super Bowl win, and then you think differently.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll tell you what, if they somehow win the Super Bowl with this guy this year,
I think that is... Well, one, you think differently of Lamar, and you start thinking of him historically. And then secondly, I do think the Ravens as a historical franchise, you think differently of them.
Yeah. We will take a break when we come back. Gord Stellick, he's host of our Leafs Nation pre- and post-game on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We will have tomorrow's game between the Buffalo Sabres and the Leafs on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. What time is the puck drop, Travis? I believe it's 4 o'clock. And we'll be on 360 from 3 to 5 anyhow. I think I got that right.
4 o'clock puck drop. We're on 360, 3:30 to 5.
3:30 to 5. There you go.
2 to 5, but 360 only, 3:30 to 5.
Okay. We'll be on 2 to 5.
I thought for a second I was getting off. Only. I was excited. TV only, huh?
No.
All right.
Work your ass off here, believe me. Gord Stellick's next. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Reminder, you have a chance to win the Lotto 649 jackpot seats and see the Leafs and Avalanche on Wednesday. Well, that's a good game. These seats are the best in the house. They're located right at the glass at Center Ice. You can experience that 649 feeling. Once you enter, tune into Leafs Hour from 10 to 11 a.m. tomorrow morning with JD and Ben to listen for the cue to call. You can submit your entries and find out more details at sportsnet.ca/590. And as always, this contest is open to Ontario residents only. So if you live outside of Ontario, you're SOL.
You know, I just saw him walking by.
Who?
Justin Bourne. Still, the guy, he's never left.
Still here.
Literally has not, like he's I not said, left the station in 72 hours.
I told you that he was, I told you that.
I just waved to him behind us. I
told you that he was working at the Timmy's, outside by my house yesterday. I stopped, gassed the car up, went to Timmy's. Justin Bourne's there.
Yeah, tomorrow he'll be on the Leafs penalty killing unit. He has every job here.
Tomorrow, the Leafs penalty-killing unit will be on the ice in Buffalo against the Buffalo Sabres. The Leafs coming off a 6-0 win over the Red Wings last night. And as I said, that really was the definition of laugher. Poor Jimmy Howard gets hurt. Jonathan Bernier coming out looking. I mean, they might as well stuck a puke bucket next to him playing despite the fact that he was under the weather. And apparently lying on the trainer's table. So he went out, answered the call. Did not embarrass himself, to be quite honest, but the Leafs still won 6-0. And Gord Stellick, the parade route is being planned as we speak, is it not?
I just said I had to pick up an expensive hockey stick for son Justin at one of those stores. And yes, Tyson Barrie is going to get 82 goals. The parade route, Leafs will never lose. It's one of those weeks we've kind of been looking forward to fans getting a little over the top again.
Well, it's like... You know, that's exactly right. That's a great point. This is kind of what I thought the whole season would feel like, to be honest, Gord. I really did.
Well, you know, we've talked many times, and I use one example that it was a Leaf win 3-1 over the Los Angeles Kings a couple of weeks ago. And Mike Babcock just said, oh, I love that game. That was a beautiful game.
Right.
It was the worst game I'd seen all season. And I felt like saying...
Including losses.
Yeah. Yeah, Roger Nielsen's not reincarnated. The Leafs are not an expansion team. This is the way you tried to win in the P.A. Parenteau era. Come on, you got a talented squad here. When you saw Pittsburgh come to town, Crosby, Malkin kick your butt. Chicago, it was Taves and Kane. Washington, it's Ovechkin. Now you got some guns. And why are we not seeing the guns going? And that was what baffled me. So I would rather hang on for dear life against Colorado when you almost didn't make it, but get four goals. And I thought there would be laughers like this against the weaker teams last night more often than there have been.
Gord, at this point, fair to say Sheldon Keefe is the equivalent of Scotty Bowman and Toblik? Or is it a little early?
Jesus, don't.
Yeah, Dick Irvin, Punch Imlach, all these. What's interesting, Richard, though, I don't know how many other situations in the NHL of the other 30 that the heir apparent is right there.
Right.
Like obviously Calgary's a situation where they got to think what they're going to need to do. They hadn't really been thinking about it. And, you know, most places last year, it's not like the St. Louis Blues automatically had Craig Berube in mind to promote him. They had to make a decision. So, you know, we know he's been there for a while. He knows the organization. He coached 13 of the players already. They're on the Toronto Maple Leafs. So it's a bit of a different animal. He's coming with a lot of equity and knowledge already.
So, Gord, I honestly do have a serious question for you. Understanding that the sample size is very, very small and the three teams in the sample size are not particularly great. That said, the Leafs puck possession and just sort of how they are approaching or how they have approached the last nine periods has been, I feel like, a bit of a revelation. And you hear some of these guys, in particular William Nylander, in a kind of a puck possession system, looks like an incredibly dangerous player. From your perspective, what you've seen, I mean, am I crazy to think, like, why, like, it was Mike Babcock's stubbornness so great that he couldn't see this? Because right now it looks like the system, they found what works for their skill set.
Yeah, and I think that's a valid criticism. I don't want to keep dumping on the grave of Mike Babcock professionally as he left, but it's something that is that evident right away, isn't it, Richard? And I know Jeff would be a little bit more well-versed about the brief Peter Horacek era than I think you were, but you remember, Jeff, Peter Horacek said 5-5-5, all five guys will be in each zone at the same time. That was his plan, and Phil Kessel and company said, no, we'll be in no zones. We'll be in whatever zone you want. And, you know, they went out and lost their first four games, got clobbered, three in California, one in St. Louis, and the strategy never came together. So that's something team-wise that is really evident. And obviously, you know, the guys know that's his style. It's not just a unique style, and they seem to be enjoying it or liking it and buying into it. That's the key thing, buying into it that last term.
It's interesting. Luke Fox has an article up on sort of how the Leafs are planning to use Michael Hutchinson and why exactly they're giving him a second chance. How do you view that whole situation? And I'm looking. I don't know. Has it been announced yet who's starting tomorrow? I don't know. But
hadn't been announced yet. But right now, I think Sheldon has figured out that he's the new guy, so he should do things different than his predecessor did. And I never understood, you know, Jeff and Richard, I heard you on, you know, one of, say, Bob's last show on Primetime Sports. And you guys both talked about guys that had given you breaks in the broadcasting business. Mm-hmm. And Jeff, you went back to Montreal days and what have you. And you think about people that gave you a chance to succeed in this business. Otherwise, maybe you never get going. And Mike Babcock would cite that back-to-back games, the one team, the tired team won 29% of the time. And that's what he would put Michael Hutchinson in those games. Like, give the guy a chance to win a game. Like, help him out. Give, you know, that kind of thing. This is one element I never understood because it still is a real problem. I mean, Vegas, Malcolm Subban finally won his first game last night as a backup. And I got to feel, I would hope that Hutchinson's going to get that start in Buffalo on Friday and Freddie would play on Saturday.
Yeah, Gord, I'm glad you said that because to me, that always sounded like an excuse. That sounded like a coach saying, well, I can go ahead and use the backup, and then the numbers aren't going to be against me. And I want my head coach thinking, you know what? Maybe I can change the numbers a bit if I use my best guy out there and give the other guy a chance in the first game. That and not putting Tyson Berry in the power play were just things that drove me nuts. It just did.
And I'll talk about Tyson Berry in a sec, but also Henrik Lundqvist a couple of weeks ago, he went back-to-back and he had wins, and he's one of the older goalies. And every now and then I think you'll have to ride Freddie back-to-back and maybe pick another game to put the backup goaltender in. But, you know, Jeff and Richard, when you think about it, in the Tyson Berry case, I'm not nuts when I say this, is that he really is the Toronto Maple Leafs version of Kawhi Leonard. And I'm not saying he's Kawhi. He's not as good as Kawhi Leonard, but he is the guy that, like the Raptors did, you get 1 year with.
Right.
You gave up a great contract to Nazem Kadri. I mean, you gave up a great, a solid player and a club-friendly contract. So you get 1 year that you know of with this guy, and he's invisible. Like, mm-hmm. It wasn't even to play badly. You didn't see him. And you're kind of saying, well, wait a second. That's really, to me, on the coach about, here's an asset you've been provided. You got to get whatever you can out of this year, because we know the Leafs are very strong up front. They have some struggles depth-wise on the blue line, and this is your one-year ad that can walk at the end of the season, and you're getting nothing from them. And like the Raptors did with Kawhi Leonard, I mean, again, that's an extreme. He was an MVP. You know, they said about a load management thing. They did everything. And the coach was doing nothing here to try to promote Tyson Barrie thriving with the Toronto Maple Leafs, and the new coach has already done it in 1 week.
Gord, you bring up something that's really interesting to me, and I want to get your perspective on this. And again, I understand that the sports are very different and the cultures are different, but I'm a big NBA watcher, as I think everybody on the station knows. So here's something I just want to say. When it comes to the NBA, and you brought up Kawhi Leonard, the entire sports coaching setup and system is to make players comfortable, to put them in the best possible positions to succeed, whether that's on the court or off the court, where too often I feel like in the NHL, and Mike Babcock's a perfect example of this, it's to make players uncomfortable as a motivational tactic. And then when you get to Tyson Barrie, I think that's a perfect example of, from the jump, not putting him or not structuring him in a place where he can succeed, as opposed to Tyson Barrie has to come into the organization and fit into Mike Babcock's vision of the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the part that really makes no sense for me, not at all. It's kind of like Mike Babcock saying to Kyle Dubas, we got this guy, but he's got to play a certain way. We got Jason Spezza, but I'm going to sort of get things going in training camp, like an orientation week for him,
right,
that he's going to have to buy into my style, as Jason Spezza kind of goes, what the heck's going on here? And then I don't dress him his first game at home. I mean, all these kinds of things. And that these are the parts that I found very baffling. But, you know, Mike Babcock, it has been his way. And we learn later with that Mitch Marner thing in the first year that, you know, his tactics are he pushes buttons. And certainly in the Marner case, that's a weird button about the list to put together. But, you know, it's a fine line. It's a tough thing about pushing different buttons as a hit and miss thing. And I just, these buttons he was pushing this year, they just weren't playing the right songs.
Hey, Gord, you sat in the general manager's chair. What's your view of the Bill Peters situation, where we are right now? And I mean, look, it seems pretty apparent he's coached his last game with the Flames, and you know, the lawyers are trying to figure out how the hell he get out of this. But what's your view of this situation?
Well, it's just going to keep exploding onward, say exploding, or just evolving or devolving. And I think, you know, Jeff, in a lot of ways, I was gone from the organization by then. But you go back to what happened at Maple Leaf Gardens, and it was a societal mm-hmm. issue. It was a societal lesson. It was a very important societal lesson that happened in churches and hockey groups and, you know, Cubs and all these kinds of things, and that we learned from it. And here's another one. And first of all, from the GM's point of view, the Calgary Flames, it's funny, they're the one team that really is absolved of anything, because it didn't happen
right
when he was with the Calgary Flames. So I'm stunned still that a guy could actually use the N-word, which I don't know the last time I've heard somebody use it in public. It doesn't mean that people aren't racist anymore. They certainly are, but they're not stupid enough to use that word. I mean, and so now you've got the Chicago Blackhawk organization, to a degree,
yep,
probably having to answer about it. Then the thing comes out in Carolina, and now you got the owner, the former owner, taking issue with how it was handled. If he would have known his owner, and his general manager is the guy running the Seattle franchise now, in Ron Francis. So there's this domino effect about how it affects different organizations that way. And certainly a code of conduct now, which we as hockey parents have to do all the time in that. I mean, That's understandable. I'm just surprised that, you know, I was a GM for a guy named John Brophy, and if anyone would get physical or something, you would think it'd be somebody like that. So, you know, in Bill Peters' case, it's probably a very constructive societal thing we're going through. And I'm just, and DJ Smith, good on him. He spoke up, because
yes,
Hakeem Olu, I mean, what happened to him in Windsor was criminal. Okay. Mm-hmm. What happened to him? The kid got initiated, didn't like it, and got sucker punched in practice, lost, what, six teeth. And then he goes to Rockford, starts his pro career, and that's what he and that's what happens. So he waited, of course, till his hockey career was over, and you understand why. And now, you know, these kind of stories, if it can help at the NHL side and help educate us all as in every single sport, kid sport, whatever, then it's going to be constructive.
Yeah, that's really well said, Gordon. And to me right now, Richard and I had this discussion. I want to see, look, I want Bill Peters to be punished. I think he will be punished. You know, this idea that, well, times were different 10 years ago. I'm 59 years old. I don't ever remember it being allowable to use that word. 10 years ago, 30 years ago, 40. I don't remember anybody ever saying, well, it's okay to use that word. It's okay. But I'm interested in two things now, Gordon. I'm interested in who knew what when with the Blackhawks, and I'm really interested in Ron Francis. And I think that's one of the things Peter Karamanos really put on the table, the former owner of the Hurricanes. He really put that on the table today, didn't he? That I'm trying to get a hold of Ron Francis.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know whether it was Tom Dundon or Don Waddell, but it was weird that Bill Peters left Carolina in the first place. Remember, it was kind of puzzling. He seemed to be doing okay there. And I wonder if this is something that, see, Tom Dundon wouldn't have been there in the crossover. Don Waddell would have been before, not so much there, but would have maybe had a grasp of what happened. And maybe that's part of why they made that move when it was a little puzzling to other people. But yeah, Ron Francis has to do what Rod Brind'Amour did yesterday. And I don't mind, you know, Jeff and Richard in this case, because first of all, the N word, I'm with you. I just don't hear it anymore. And it would be suicide in any profession to use it. We know John Van Beesbrouck years ago, he had to divest himself of a junior A team.
Mm-hmm.
That's about 15 years ago. But the other part is I'm willing to hear what they have to say and how it was handled. And maybe it should have been handled more severely. I know the owner says I would have got rid of him in a nanosecond had I known. But, you know, all the facts about that and where maybe there's allegations against other coaches. You know, some people are bringing up Sutter's. Patrick O'Sullivan, about Mark Crawford, about starting off their careers and feeling that they were a little bit unfairly treated. And that's debatable. And we'll wait and see what more comes out. But also, how was it handled? And also, at some point, you know, when you commit a crime, you do get paroled. Okay. So at some point, you have to wear it for the rest of your life. But how long, you know, how long do you have to suffer with it and not get a chance, depending on the severity of what someone does, to get back in their profession?
It's a good question, Gord, although I do think there are some transgressions where you shouldn't be back in the profession.
Oh, absolutely.
And I might argue using racial slurs in a position of authority, particularly with young people and young people of color, this is just my personal viewpoint, that would preclude me from ever having you in my profession. That said, I think your statement and thought is very fair that, you know, people do commit crimes, they do serve their time, and the system should be set up for people to be employed after the fact. The question is, what employment after the fact?
Yeah, and I'm with you on the first part about, like, you know, the use of the language by a guy, somebody in authority. You're, as far as I'm concerned, you're professionally dead. You better get an independent contractor thing doing something. But the other stuff, I'm just curious, because, again, it was a bit of a different time. Coaches were in their faces more, and they might have been a background about, you know, whatever. And I don't know what you consider, again, they're talking kicking, punching, which I find that absurd. But just in general, about what to what degrees in professional hockey it's right for a coach to get in the face, or whatever you want to call it, of a player. And this is going to be healthy dialogue.
Gordy, great of you to do this, man. I really appreciate it.
And I heard you mention it before. Yes, I know you guys are going to be moved tomorrow, and we'll have the game tomorrow afternoon. It should be a dandy.
Yes, it will be. Buffalo and Toronto. Thanks, Gordy.
Thanks, Gord.
Okay, guys.
Gord Stellick, host of our Leafs Nation pre- and post-game on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Leafs Nation pregame tomorrow, 3:30, ahead of puck drop at 4 o'clock. We've had to do a little bit of juggling here. Ren LeVar, NHL insider with TVS Sports, will join us at 4. Nick Nurse will join us at 4:40 as a result of the Raptors charter into Orlando. Late. So anyhow, so Nick Nurse joins us later on in the show. And interesting hearing Gord talk about the child abuse scandal that developed around Maple Leaf Gardens years and years ago, and the impact that had on, as Gord said, I mean, that was one of the, that was sort of one of the points where the whole relationship between younger athletes, older coaches, and you know, sort of started to come to the forefront along with the, as I mentioned, the Graham James incident, something where people started having a dialogue about it. I mean, I think, you know, Brian Burke said a little earlier today, this is hockey's Me Too moment. And I think it's exactly, and it's exactly what it is. I don't know where it's going to, I don't know where it's going to go. I do know this though. I do know this regardless of what happens with Bill Peters or anything. Hockey coaching is going to be, and I'm talking about coaching, not who's your third line. I'm talking about how you go about relating to your players.
For sure.
That's changing. That's changed as a result of this. This has.
The one thing, and it sort of speaks a little bit to what Brian Burke was saying, the one thing I really appreciate is, and these are important, uncomfortable conversations to have, and I say uncomfortable as a positive, not a negative, but I really appreciate the fact that, you know, there's a lot of ills that exist because of social media and the Facebooks and the Twitters. One of the really good things, though, Jeff, and I tip my hat to Daniel Carcillo, who, you know, people now have the ability to tell their stories publicly. And Daniel Carcillo has, on his Twitter feed, you know, been telling the stories of junior hockey players and some of the abuse from coaches that they've taken. And these stories have to get out. Like, now is the time for them to come out. And if you don't want to put your name to it and you want to be anonymous, that's okay too. But, like, I understand what Brian Burke is saying on a larger thing, is that, like, these stories can no longer be hidden under something. Like, now, they have to get out.
I would like, and be careful how he says, I'd like more people to go on record with it, because what happens when a whole bunch of people start unleashing stuff off the record is, quite frankly, I tune out because I don't know whether or not it's true.
Yeah. There's some things, you know, though, there's some abuses that are very hard for people to go publicly.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that at all. And I certainly wouldn't want people to stop coming public,
right,
coming out, you know, and describing these issues. And because I think the more you build up a body of evidence,
agreed,
that it's systemic, the greater the chance that the system itself is going to change. But I'm saying, I'm looking at it from kind of a, not necessarily a legalistic point of view, but I'm looking at it from a league sort of management point of view, and not just the NHL. I'm talking about hockey league. You need evidence to affect change.
Yes.
Part of changing things, yes, part of changing things is changing the culture and everything, but there has to be an element of punishment to make change work. There has to be an element of punishment to make change work.
And
without evidence, without names, that punishment is going to be impossible to dole out.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say is that this is where I agree with you on, and I don't know another word to use, but the role of the whistleblower here, Jeff, is, you can't understate. Like, that's how institutions change, is because somebody has the courage usually to put their name to it, as painful as it might be. Because you do need, a lot of times, you do need a face for this change. But I think it's coming. And I think the more these stories get out there, and I know what's floating around Twitter right now is a story from the Spitting Chicklets podcast, where we're going to start to hear from players. I think a lot of players about abuse that's happened in every coaching ranks of hockey.
You know, I did a podcast with Jordan Heath Rawlings that's up right now. And one of the points I made in the podcast, and I really believe this, is somebody who's spent time around athletes and covered sports for a while. I think what we're seeing is, and thank goodness, because it's something a lot of us have been talking about. I think we have a generation of hockey players who are going to take charge of things.
Yeah.
You know, and I made the point, this is a great moment for the NHLPA and for NHL players in general. Because instead of just focusing on economic aspects, you have a real chance right now to start affecting change beyond simply how much money you're going to get when you're going to become a free agent. And I think this generation of hockey players, even though I understand a lot of the stuff that's coming out now is coming up from guys who are no longer in the game, I think just this generation of hockey fans or of hockey players is starting to get it. Yeah. What Mitch Marner said yesterday about if you have a story, tell it.
And
I don't think that's been getting enough play in the media, because now you have a young hockey player saying, telling, and what Mitch Marner says is going to resonate with 15, 16-year-old kids a hell of a lot more, with all due respect, than what some 45-year-old former NHL player says. Yeah. Mitch Marner saying, hey, if you got a story, tell the story. That, to me, is one of the most significant statements to come out of this. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue the dialogue. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, the Fan of Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, the Fan.
Whoa. Bren Lavoie from TVS Sports will join us in a few minutes. We'll take a look around the NHL, talk about the Montreal Canadiens. A little bit of a set to in practice the other day between Victor Mete and Max Domi. We'll talk to Bren about that and get Ren's take on this whole, how this whole situation is playing out, especially in Quebec, which is kind of, I was going to say, its own world when it comes to hockey. And I mean that certainly don't mean that in a pejorative way, but it'll be interesting to see sort of what impact this is having from Ren's point of view. We mentioned that the Leafs will take on the Buffalo Sabres tomorrow, the first of a back-to-back game. We'll have that game at 4 o'clock on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. Leafs Nation pregame will be at 3:30. We will be on 360 during the game, so you can flip back and forth. And again, the Leafs Nation pregame, 3:30 p.m.
Yeah. Be fun 4 to be on the air. Game. Fun to be on the air with a game.
Well, not really. No, it's not, because
I'm just saying
to be on the game on the air when there's no game.
Right, well, now. I understand that, Jeff. I'm just saying that we'll actually rare that we can actually comment live on a Leafs game. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
Yeah, that's less people.
Yes.
No Leafs game. More people listening. I get that.
What are you talking about, Travis?
Yeah, Travis, you're making...
Fire up Travis's microphone. I can't hear what
you're making way too many motions.
What?
I was saying it's a good point by Richard, but remember, we'll be fully available on podcast after the show.
There you go. We'll be fully available on podcast after the show. Very quickly after the... As indeed we are every day. Indeed we are every day.
Writer's Block, Apple Podcasts. Please leave us a five-star review if you are so inclined and subscribe. Or a six-star review. It's possible. I don't think that's possible. Any review at this point will be awesome.
I love playing this game. The just shut up and let Deitch ramble game.
I know, Blair.
It's
I will say
so
it's,
good.
It's
you can call me Jeff, by the way.
Jeff. It's
sorry, I was just kidding.
Oh, it's true. It is. I will say.
I'm sorry. I feel bad now.
It is hard to. It's always hard to react when somebody sort of goes silent on one of these formats. That's tough.
I know.
Yeah. See, I like you're not intentionally selling me out, but it's the same act of selling me out. So it
it's not.
It does make it hard for the for me. I have to come up with something, and then I start scrambling. The Jets are scrambling. It's bad.
No, it's good because it allows people to see
the true personality
inside you. It allows them to see the workings of your mind.
You don't want to see
it. It allows them to see how you process stuff. I think it helps warm up the audience. I think it's good to let stuff breathe.
I'm with you on
it's
that.
It's good to let stuff breathe.
Dramatic pausing in radio is good.
Loved what Jim Nantz said yesterday about the review. They got a lot of traction. A lot of people like that idea about televising, sticking TV cameras in the video review.
Pretty good idea from
Nantz. It's a great idea.
Who's coming up in a couple of minutes? He's
couple
got
of minutes
call
indeed.
The Cowboys.
So is Ren Lavoie. It's Writer's Block on 590 and 360.
They are rewriting afternoon sports radio one word at a time. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Nick Nurse, the head coach of the Toronto Raptors, joins us later on in the show ahead of the Raptors and Magic Friday on Sportsnet Ontario. And Sportsnet 1, 6:30 pregame, 7 o'clock tip-off on Sportsnet Ontario. Leafs, Sabres. Sound fancy pronunciation of Sabres. Sabres. Leafs and Sabres tomorrow, 3:30 on Sportsnet 590. The Fan is our pregame. Puck drops just after 4. And Hockey Night in Canada and Sportsnet Ontario will have the return game Saturday, the second half of the back-to-back, as the Sabres take on your Toronto Maple Leafs at Scotiabank Arena on Saturday. Got the Devils and Habs tonight at 7 o'clock on Sportsnet if you're jonesing for some hockey. Speaking of which, the Habs, the Montreal Canadiens, Ren Lavoie is our NHL insider with Tavia Sports. Ren Lavoie joining us now in Writer's Block. Monsieur Lavoie, thank you very much for doing this. What's going on in Montreal? What's this Max Domi Victor Mete set to that I'm reading about?
No, that wasn't much. And that's why I put on my tweet, right? There wasn't like anything big there. It wasn't major. It was just two guys battling because it was a hard practice yesterday. And at one point, hands of both players came up in the face of the other, but it was in the middle of the ice with us. It wasn't close to the board. And like I said, it's nothing major. Mm. It's just I went to see Victor Mete after, and I told him that it was a good idea not to go further with Max. And he said, I know that. And I asked him, did you ever fought? He said, never. Never, ever. Because Dale Hunter, when I was in junior, told me, you drop these gloves and you're not playing anymore.
Yeah.
I said, that's all. And Victor, obviously, is not the biggest guy, but you know how it is. You're playing hockey. You want to show the rest of the world that you're a tough customer, that it's not easy playing against you. So, but Victor understood, I think, a while ago that that was not in his DNA. So we're not going to see that soon.
Montreal lost 8-1 to the Bruins on Tuesday. What's happened since they had that? They had a 4-0 lead against the Rangers on Saturday. They've been outscored 14-2 since Carey Price was pulled. When is the last time Carey Price was pulled from a game?
It was in December of 17 in Edmonton. So it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Versus the Oilers. Was it in Edmonton? I'm not 100%, but I feel it was in Edmonton. But 100% versus the Oilers. So it was a while ago. Not a surprise. And Carey, I guess there was maybe one occasion in Minnesota that mm-hmm. he could have been pulled, okay? And Carey asked to stay because it was his mess. And he told the coaches, I want to finish that game. And my players are finishing that game. I want to finish it too. The other night versus Boston was a different story because I do believe that Carey didn't felt like he was really there starting the second period. He allowed a quick goal, and the goal after, he didn't move much on a breakaway. So the right decision was made at the time, and it happens. I mean, after 112 starts,
mm-hmm.
being pulled only once, I mean, for the first time, I should say, it's not the end of the world here. But one thing I'm going to mention again, Carey 100% understood the coach's decision, but when he's not playing well, he really likes to stay because he wants to show the rest of his teammates that he's with them.
Mm-hmm.
He said, when you're going back on the bench, you're not playing anymore, he feels sometimes that he's letting down the rest of the group because the rest of the group still has to play, even if it's 5-6, 7-8-1.
Ren, we've been talking with every hockey guest who's come on this show in the last couple of days about Bill Peters, but not just Bill Peters, but the larger conversation about hockey culture involving the relationship between coaches and players, obviously the slurs that are alleged Bill Peters to have said. From your perspective, Ren, what have you thought about in the last 72 hours regarding this?
I'll be honest with you, I was in total shock. There's no other way to put it, okay? Because I know coaching, especially, let's say, I'm going to obviously concentrate what I've seen in junior in Quebec to start with. The first coach that I saw was Pat Burns behind a bench, and he wasn't an easy customer, okay? So I started with Pat Burns, and after that was Alain Vigneault and all Claude Julien, all the great coaches that went through the whole Olympics. I was really lucky to watch you know, coaches like that at a young age. And, I mean, I know it was tough. I know the culture was different than today, okay? But there's a line that was crossed there, and I couldn't believe it. And the N-word is, somebody asked me, well, should we go back? Should we, you know, cut and say, maybe after 10 years, we shouldn't go there and say it's mm-hmm. it's in the past. I said, no, there's no it's in the past. That's the reality. You're not, it's to make racist comments. It wasn't good, a good thing to say in the 80s or the 90s. I don't, mm-hmm. there's no cutoff. Okay. And, but that kicking thing and slapping thing when Bill Peters was coaching the Carolina Hurricanes, I couldn't believe it. You know, I'm lucky enough to be between the benches, for more than 100 games now, in the NHL. Never, ever, ever in my life, I saw a coach, first of all, losing his mind. Second of all, slapping, punching, doing anything over the line to a player. Never, never even close, to be honest with you. Never crossed my mind that it was possible. So, and I'm looking, I'm not looking for these type of actions, obviously, but I like to look what's, first of all, you need to look what's going on. Is there an injured player? What the coach going to do? Is he going to call a timeout? There's a situation with the refs sometimes. You have to look from time to time to see what exactly is being done on those benches. That's my role, right? Mm-hmm. So, and you know what? I never, ever seen a coach losing his mind on a player like verbally. They're all professionals. There are some cameras everywhere.
Yeah.
And they understand that. Even Claude Julien, let's say Claude Julien. When Claude Julien has something to say to his players, you know where he, when he's doing it? And I mean on the bench to mm-hmm. everybody. They're losing maybe 3-1 or 4-1. He has a message to send. Sometimes he's not, majority of the times, he's not calling a timeout. But when the puck is dropped, he's walking on the bench and he's loud. And he's telling the rest of his group that he's not satisfied with the way things are going and they need to wake up. But he's doing it when the play is going on. Why? He knows there's no camera on him. But at the same time, even if there was a camera on him, there's nothing bad coming out of his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched Mike Babcock so many times. I mean, never, ever, ever Mike Babcock did something wrong with any of his players when I was there. And I imagine it never happened. So that's why today it's kind of a strange day, because I feel, maybe you feel it too, that there's a lot of people waiting for the other shoe to drop. Like, mm-hmm. who's going to be the next guy?
Mm-hmm.
If you look around the league, you look at all the head coaches, I don't see anybody, to be honest with you. I don't see anybody who's going to be on the block, or somebody's going to point fingers at him soon. I don't believe it. I believe that these guys are real pros, and I'm sure that, you know, I can't be 100% sure, but I do believe that the 31 coaches in the NHL right now are classy people, and that's the way I feel about these coaches.
Do you think, Ren, that, we've seen the story today, Peter Karamanos, the former owner of the Hurricanes, saying if he'd known about this, about the physical abuse, Bill Peters would have been gone in a nanosecond. And he essentially said, I need to hear from Ron Francis. Look, Ron Francis is now the public face of a new franchise in Seattle. He's kind of becoming the focus of this whole thing now, isn't he?
Yeah, but I'll be really careful
mm-hmm.
because it depends on what version you have.
Yep.
What I have is he was aware as a GM, and when the excuses were made, he was there. When Bill Peters addressed the rest of the group, the GM, Ron Francis, was in the room.
This is about the physical abuse. Yeah.
Physical abuse.
Yeah.
So, and when you, if you go back to what Rod Brandamore said yesterday, was crystal clear that he said that management took care of that problem really quickly and did it the right way. So after that, do you have to tell your owner what happened?
That's interesting.
Mm.
That's, you know, Mr. Carmanos was sometimes always there, but after he was really in and out, and at the end he wasn't even close to be there.
That's
fair. So I wasn't there, obviously. Like everybody, I was in shock when I heard about these things. But I've been told 100% that Ron Francis was there when the excuses were made.
Mm. Wow.
Ren, do you, in your travels, particularly in junior hockey, have you heard any kind of similar stories where coaches are literally putting their hands on players?
Never. Never. You know, I talked to Dave Morissette. Dave played for the Montreal Canadiens a little bit, but was around the league. Like, he played everywhere. Mm-hmm. East Coast, IHL, obviously the AHL, in junior. I mean, Dave's job was not easy, okay? Yeah. And he told us this week, if ever a coach was thinking about being physical, he would have responded automatically, and he never seen that. And that's why it's important to mention here, this is not common. This is not what the NHL is. This is not what coaches are. It's not true. Some maybe cross that line. They're paying the price today. Are we going to hear about others? Probably. Okay, probably. But they're not head coaches anymore in the NHL. That's my feeling. So, to say that kicking or punching a player is the reality for pro hockey players, I don't believe it. It wasn't the case 20 or 30 years ago. I'm not saying never happened, but that's not the norm. That's not what coaching is, and that's not what the coaches are. They're not doing that. They can be upset, obviously. They can say stuff that they regret, but I don't believe that, you know, being racial or using race, religion is part of what they were saying to those players. No, I don't believe it. I don't believe it, but I'm sure. And Michel Bergeron, coach of Quebec Nordiques.
Oh, yes.
Said today, you know what I did? There's maybe a thousand things that I regret. Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably. But I mean, in today's world, I don't believe that it's part of coaching anymore since a long, long time.
You know, and it's interesting hearing you talk about that because, you know, as you were talking, an email from somebody, you know, Francophone hockey players and by extension, Francophone coaches, they had to put up with this, you know, when they were years ago. I mean, I don't know if it still happens, but Ren, you know, I mean, players used to call French players frogs, you know, and a lot of that went on. And I find it's interesting hearing that point of view. I think that, you know, Quebec in particular, I think would be pretty sensitive to this when it comes to these issues.
Yeah. I'm totally with you. I've been called frogs. It never hurt me.
Right.
Because you know what? I don't think it's racist.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, and I may be totally out of line here, but I don't consider myself as a frog anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is a frog?
Mm-hmm.
Why, you know, it's.
For but me, that was the word that was used a lot in the 50s and 60s, right?
Yeah, but who cares?
Yeah.
Honestly, I never understood that, you know, why people were saying that about French Canadians.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in a tough area in Hull. We had to play, obviously, hockey in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was going on. And if they were calling us frogs, who cares? I mean, we were still winning that game anyway.
You know, that's right.
Honestly, I understand that. I remember Patrice Brisebois one time. There was a game in Ottawa, was called a fraud, I think, by Vaclav Prospal.
Yes. Prospal was suspended, I think, was he not?
No, I don't remember him being suspended for that. But that being said, you're playing pro sports. At the same time, if you have a sensitive skin, if you have a problem, okay, there's a line.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things being said. There's a lot of things being said, I'm telling you. But the guys right now, they're that's not the way they act anymore. Yep. They're not doing that anymore. They can say a lot of things, but they're not going to – they're especially, they're never going to go races off-limit by so – I mean, it's not even close.
Right.
This is unacceptable for everybody. But I understand that in Quebec – yes, people, maybe there was some sensitive skin, but, it makes you a little tougher. That's how I see it, to be honest with you.
Ren, we're going to let you run. Appreciate you doing this, man. Yeah. Have a great weekend, as always.
Enjoy your weekend. There's a lot of sports on TV. That's great.
Absolutely. Take care.
Take care.
All righty. This is Ren LaVar, NHL insider with AVS Sports. And that's one thing there's a generation of hockey fans who need to remember that. I mean, there was a time where I'll just go back and do your reading on Rocket Richard. I mean, there was a very strong element of anti-Francophone sentiment. Anti-Francophone sentiment preceded the anti-European sentiment.
Mm.
And I'm just saying that was the case in Canadian society. That was not just hockey. Hockey reflects Canadian society, though. So I just, the idea that there, I guess what I'm saying is stuff happened before Bill Peters walked into the dressing room and dropped an N-bomb.
Well,
stuff happened.
And
Quebec in particular, like I can remember, working in Montreal, Quebec, I was a rivalry. And the Quebec Nordique were the French team. And the Montreal Canadiens were owned by the English. They were the English team.
Mm.
And there were a hell of a lot of words. I mean, I was at those, watching those games. There were a hell of a lot of words exchanged in the stands by fans.
Well, just it sort of reminds me of the of what you said the day that Don Cherry was dismissed from this network about at one point everybody's the other, and people should understand like sort of the power of those kind of. Those kind of words. And listen, Ren is correct. Like, it has no place in hockey. The question is, does it exist? And that's something that I hope will now be examined.
Hearing all the stuff now about Mark Crawford, we talked about Daryl Sutter.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing is, I want people to take this the way exactly as I say it. The coaches we are hearing, I didn't know anything about Bill Peters, but the coaches we are hearing talked about, I don't think anybody in the NHL is surprised that they're the ones being talked about. That was part of their reputation as coaches. And I think that's maybe more than anything else. I'm trying to remember who made the point to us on air, Richard, that a lot of the guys who are coaching in the NHL now are former players.
And it makes a big difference.
That, which is odd because it's, Major League Baseball, they're hiring guys who weren't players. You don't need to have an experience as a Major League player to coach in the majors. And I'm wondering if that has an impact on coaching. Guys were treated, if someone treats you improperly, there are two ways you go. If you're a player, you're treated improperly and you become a coach, there are two ways you can go. One, that's the way I was treated, so to hell with these guys.
Right.
Or two, I remember what that felt like.
Right.
And I'm not going to do it. And I like to think that maybe we're seeing coaches skew more that way now?
Well, I was critical of Rod Brind'Amour yesterday, but I come today to praise him because I thought he was very, very eloquent and smart about that. Today's player is different than yesterday's player, and he, as a former player, offered some pretty thoughtful points about, like, having gone through that old school kind of coaching, that's just not something that can happen anymore.
And this is interesting.
You're onto something.
And Wren also dropped a little bit of a little nugget here. If, as he is led to believe, and listen, or, you know, Wren's NHL sources are pretty good.
Yeah.
If Ron Francis was in the room when Bill Peters apologized to the Carolina Hurricanes players for the physical abuse, that at least suggests that some responsibility was assumed. And then the question gets to, why did ownership not know about it? And that, now you're getting into, as a general manager, Ron Francis may say, yeah, I took care of it, man. That's my job. My job as general manager is to help put out fires. This adds another layer to it. And that's why I'm saying, I think we ultimately, I understand the physical abuse is separate, completely separate from the racial abuse in terms of the law right now. What is being discussed with the Calgary Flames and Bill Peters' lawyers probably isn't what he did in Carolina. It's the alleged racial incident when he was employed by Rockford. But
like all these investigations, Jeff, ultimately it goes up the chain of command,
yes,
and you need to hear from the highest member of the chain of command. Yep. And right now that's Ron Francis.
Yeah. And, you know, we've heard from the owner, Peter Karamanis. We need to hear from Ron Francis. We'll take a break. We come back. We will get you set for Nick Nurse. He is head coach of the Toronto Raptors there in Orlando. We'll have that game tomorrow night on Sportsnet Ontario. The Raptors taking on the 7-10 Magic. 6:30 pregame, 7 o'clock tip off. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590. The Fan of Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Stop your hands, stomp your feet, jump up and down, do anything that you want to do.
Welcome back to Writer's Block. I think I got to remember on TV, because normally when we take our break, I usually put my feet up on the desk.
I'm sure that's been caught on.
Oh, it has. Apparently the other day it was caught.
Yeah, I mean.
Oh, yesterday it was caught. But that's just how chill I am, right?
I know.
This environment. Like, people, if you only knew the stuff we talk about. Like, it's the vibe during the break is pretty chill. It is.
Usually quiet, yeah, we're checking our phones and stuff. Checking, you know, McCown phones. Used to take off, so he would never
he'd go out and have a coffin nail.
Yeah, he would never get caught with his...
I'm going to start doing it this summer, because I've become a cigar smoker now, so I'm going out. I've developed... I want it to change my
voice.
I've
never had a cigar in my
Cigar life. Smoking is great, yeah. I'm told, to change your voice.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I will say, I do have a frequent phobia, paranoia of in the break... My elbow hitting the mic on. And I probably should ask, like, Travis or Brandeo or, you know, Marchese or wherever. Like, if that happens, like, does it go live to everybody?
We have had hot mic incidents. Normally what happens...
like, would it override the commercial?
What was the Dave Bedini one again? Yeah, that was particular... It was during commercial, yeah.
It overrides the commercial, right?
Yeah, let's not go with the Dave Bedini one. I forgot about that. It competes with the commercial. No, what? It's
very scary to me.
Well, yeah. And, you know, the worst thing is when, like, I have, you know, if I've got my laptop open and I'm on Twitter, because I like to see what the feedback of the show is. It's the only thing Twitter's any use for. But when somebody starts sending out a tweet and you've got hot mic in caps, and then usually Jason Rozon comes running down, that's a sign
Well, the thing is,
people have gotten in trouble for
this is where Jen Rolnick could destroy your career.
Well, no, it doesn't matter because we're not on TV at that point.
Well, you know what I'm saying
is
take
all my clothes off. It's not going to make
any difference. What I'm saying is if she gets the shot from behind you and if you have something in your laptop that should not be on the laptop, that's where careers can end. So you always got to be careful about that.
I think I just broke my laptop.
Yeah, don't slam it unless you have something on there.
Nick Nurse is going to join us in a few minutes. You know what? We haven't talked about the fact the Toronto Raptors have got a 33-0 record.
Awesome.
Home wins division, record, right? Against teams in their division.
Yeah. The division's not so great, but yes, it's impressive.
Yeah, the
12-4 right now. Am I right about that? I think
so. Yeah, the Celtics, as my man Travis McKenzie points out, Celtics and Sixers have been okay. They're 33-0.
Oh yeah, that's right. I forget the Sixers are in that. Okay, I take it back. That's pretty impressive. My apologies. For some reason, why was I thinking it was just like Brooklyn or Orlando?
I kind of tweaked onto this. I think Jonesy and Eric were talking about it a couple of games ago, and it was at 30 or something like that. And I remember thinking, yeah, they haven't lost at home to division team for a long time.
They haven't lost. I would have thought they would have been beat by Boston during that stretch, but I guess not. No, I mean that's an unbelievably impressive stretch. They've been great at home.
Yeah, the Raps beat the Knicks 126-98 last night. Travis.
Trailed for a little bit, though, in the first quarter.
What was the four Canadian players? Fill me in there. Because there was a moment last night where there were four Canadian players on the court, Canadian-born players.
As far as we can find, it is the first time in the history of the NBA four Canadians played in the same game and the same time four Canadians were on the court at once. It was O'Shea Brissett, Chris Boucher, RJ Barrett, and Ignas Brazdeikis.
There you go. So four Canadians on the court at the same time, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, the Raptors, you're right, they were losing at one point to the Knicks. I don't know.
Stepped on the gas.
Yeah, but you know, I've seen enough of this team now that...
Yeah, you're not worried. Not against the Knicks.
No,
it's Knicks good. Are garbage.
They're going to come back. Yeah. But again, the bench, Terrence Davis, Rondae Hollis Jefferson, Chris Boucher came off.
Did you see Marc Gasol hit that 29-footer?
It was a Terrence Davis. How long did it take Terrence Davis to score those 10 points? Because he came off the bench and got 10 points. They won like a 21-5. Won on a 21-5 run.
You want to know my quick...
Yes.
My NBA hot take prediction? Oh. I predict 3 years from now, RJ Barrett is a Toronto Raptor. Mark that down somewhere. When RJ is able to get to free agency, I think he comes home. That's my prediction.
Based on what?
Based on his connection to the city. Based on the fact that he's truly kind of a homegrown Canadian national team star, based on his father being so much of a fabric and part of this community.
Based on the fact he's going to be so tired of being on the crappy Knicks and
Forest. Lastly,
that's not a quick turnaround
3 years
happening.
Of dysfunction, I think he is a smart kid, and even though the Knicks will be able to obviously offer him max money, more money, I don't think, I mean, you know this, Jeff, why on earth would you ever want to commit like 7 years to the New York Knicks? That's insane.
Yeah.
You know?
We are going to take a quick break. We are awaiting Nick Nurse, the head coach of the Toronto Raptors. The Raptors are in Orlando. Plane just got in, so when we come back, we'll be joined by Nick Nurse. Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590. The Fan of Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
This is a solid game. By the way, Vic Plattian is in it. Producer of many other shows.
I know.
You'll see him.
I have seen him courtside.
You've seen courtside at Raptors game. We used to sit in those seats until they moved the media up to the corner. Now you're sitting there.
It's got a great seat.
It's a great seat. My favorite story about sitting down there, Grange. I wish Grange was here. Grange and I were sitting like front in the court. Shaquille O'Neal sits down right in front of Grange's laptop, and it moves it a bit. He goes, "Oh man, sorry about my big ass."
Yeah, not. I mean, listen, we're very appreciative of the Raptors, but me and you are very high now. We're way up.
We're not in the sky. We are high. Yeah, we're
as
high
we
when
be.
We're
we
watching.
Cover the team.
We're
on
high when
basis.
We're watching Raptors games. Yeah. We are not physically. We're not high at this point. Anyhow, Nick Nurse is the head coach of the Toronto Raptors, joins Richard Deitch and myself in Writer's Block. Nick, I apologize. I'm sure all you heard was my big ass when you came on. I was telling a story about Shaquille O'Neal sitting down and almost crushing Michael Grange's computer. So that's where the my big ass came from. Anyhow, I apologize in advance for that.
Yeah, that's okay. Good. Thanks for the context there.
I thought you'd appreciate it. Hey, okay. Yeah. 33 wins at home against your division rivals. You know, got any explanation for that? Because, as you know, Mr. Deitch said, well, maybe the division wasn't that good. And then we're thinking, well, that is the Celtics and the Sixers. And I know that having a good team is part of it. But is there something about this home court, like this home court advantage that you guys have been able to sustain?
Yeah, for sure. I think, we've got one of the better home courts in the league, if right up there at the top. I think the energy in the building is great for us, and it's awesome that we've been able to get all of them this year and have that streak, in our division. It's been good, but yeah, I don't know. Our fans are great. They're into it. They're loud. It's a great atmosphere there for sure. Helps our guys.
Nick, when you're thinking about, it's really fascinating just to think about your team because you have so many sort of pieces and combinations that you can play with. When you're thinking about rotations, do you think in terms of two-player combinations where, let's say, you always want Fred and Pascal on the court, or does it get deeper in like you like a three-player combination or a four-player combination? How does it work?
Man, would you believe I tell you that I've been piecing this thing together on the fly here a little bit lately.
I would.
Yeah, I really, there's some things, I've kind of been trying to keep either Fred or Pascal on, at least one of them at a time. I've even gotten away from that a little bit last couple of games, just trying to, buy them a little bit more rest. But there's been such, each game seems to bring something different. There's nights when we've had, I think we had four men on the floor at one time with Norman Powell the other night. Pascal was playing the point, who you consider a four. Norm was there, and then Rondé, Chris were also in there. I can't remember who the other one was, but I'm so there's been lots of odd lineups, and it's been great because I don't think it looks like we look like we're that unorganized or out of rhythm or confused or whatever. They just kind of, whatever guys we throw out there lately, they've just kind of filtered into a spot, found somebody to guard and move the ball, and the offense has seemed to play fairly composed,
I was going to say, the thing that impressed me about your bench when you started putting the combinations together after Kyle's injury and Serge's injury, it's like you got good defensive play, but I kind of assume that guys can come off the bench, they're all fired up, this is great, I can impress the coach, I can play great defense, a lot of energy, et cetera. But the thing that impressed me, Nick, was offensively the composure those guys showed almost from the get-go. What does that come from?
Well, I think a couple things. Two of them, Rondé Hollis-Jefferson and Chris Boucher, I think, did it first on energy, right? They got on the offensive glass. They got some tip-ins. They got some hard cuts on dump-offs, from Freddie or Pascal that were, high-percentage plays that they just kind of created with their energy. And then that, all of a sudden, that kind of settles you down a little bit. Rondé's got an interesting offensive game. I wouldn't say he's the most skilled, but what he does well. He cuts in hard along the baseline. He's a great finisher, reverse layups, uses his body, can spin it a little bit. And Chris hasn't been afraid. I don't think Chris has seen a shot he doesn't like for a few years now. So he comes out there and plays like he normally plays. They don't guard him at three, he's going to shoot it. And the other guy, Terrence, is a scorer, man. He's got a vault up three. He can get to the rim. He's a tremendous athlete. He's probably done more of just pure scoring, and the other two guys have done with some combination of energy than confidence. Mm.
Yeah, Nick, buy your scouting department or development staff some bubbly for Terrence Davis II, because that's a ridiculous find where you got him. I want to ask you about the value of experience in tough moments. To me, the defining characteristic of this team, which started, I think, a little bit before the playoff run and continues today, is resiliency or professionalism, however you want to use it, particularly on the defensive end. And I just wonder, when did that cement itself? And it can't necessarily have cemented itself last year, right? Because you do have some new pieces. And is the, I guess is my question, like, do guys just come in and adopt that culture because that culture exists?
Well, yeah, I think, okay, let's get to the first part of your question. Is you're right. I tell everybody it didn't really start till game two of the Orlando series. I didn't think we went out and played hard enough in game one. But in game two, we were incredible. As good a defensive performance as I've ever seen in game two of that thing. And that was kind of like, okay, guys, you now see what you can do. If you're willing to commit to this, you can go as far as you want to go. And I think it kept building through the playoffs. And then you're right. It's kind of now a little bit of an expectation. And you guys heard me complaining about the new guys a lot for the first month of training camp and whatever, that they just didn't quite get, you know, that we're going to play defense. And it's our staff, you know, that's how we want to play, but it's also, you know, I told them, I said, these guys, I point to the guys that have been here, and these guys don't want you to be around if you're not going to play the right way. Right. And that's Mark, and that's Kyle, and that's Fred, and that's OG, and that's Pascal, you know, the guys that grew and through that success and understand it. So, and then I'll give all those guys credit. You know, I mean, we started, you know, kind of having two a days where we'd have a practice, and then all the new guys had to practice again, and it was mostly on defense, and they weren't very happy about it for the first couple of days, but then they kind of took it on board and started doing it and learning our schemes a little better and playing a little harder, and I think it's paying off for them. So they've had buy-in, and it's helping them. It's helping their own individual success.
What have you learned about your team, especially in terms of ball movement without Kyle in the lineup? Is there something that you've learned that even surprises you, knowing these guys pretty well, though?
Yeah, I mean, I think our ball movement at times is awesome, right? Mm-hmm. I think we come down, you know, they had a 40 assist game, you know, that a lot of that, you know, just shooting, you know, you got to make the shots, right? And I think at times it's pretty good, but what I think other times it hasn't been that good.
Okay.
However, it hasn't bothered me. I don't really think it's that important, because I think they're taking the ball to the right matchup, or they're taking it to the right player, and then that player's making, you know, maybe a next really good decision. It may be after seven or eight dribbles, but he's making a really good decision, and we're either getting a great wide open shot, or then the next guy makes a great decision, and then we are wide open, you know, like the hockey assist or something. So it isn't a little bit, you know, like a couple of years ago when that second unit would come in and that ball would just be pinging all over the place every game. You know, it isn't like that all the time. But I think it's pretty, again, it's composed, it's smart. They're making the right reads with who's on the floor, I think.
Nick, whenever anybody asks you about meeting other coaches from other professions and what advice you've gleaned from them, you always say, "Hey, man, I'm not giving that up. That's state secrets, and I'm going to keep that," which I appreciate that. So I'm going to try to get something philosophical from you in another way. What is the best? Okay. What is the best book you've read recently that has helped you professionally?
Good question, and an easy one. I read one of Bill Walsh's old football books, just Winning the NFL Way or something, and it's gold, man. Awesome.
Before we let you run, I did want to ask you about the Canadian men's team as well. We had a lot of Canadian players committing publicly on Twitter. I'm just wondering, you know, how, given what we saw earlier this summer in the tournament, how surprised were you, and how gratified are you that you're starting to see guys just be so open about it?
Well, it is gratifying, and it's awesome. I think this is really a golden moment, right? There's 20 guys in the NBA. I think 10 guys are starting in the NBA. 10 Canadians are starters in the NBA right now. We got this Olympic qualifying tournament on home soil. You know, if you win it, you get a chance to go to the Olympics, which is, you know, a historic moment for anybody, everybody. So it's kind of lining up really good. When it didn't align very well for a little while here, it's kind of come full circle the other direction, and it's aligning good. Yeah, I'm excited, really excited. It's a heck of a chance, but I'm glad the players are, you know, getting out there and saying it. I think it's helping build momentum for the other guys, and it's nice that they're doing it publicly too, I think, because it's easy to tell everybody you talk to, yeah, I'll be there, you know, but to go out and say, you know, I'm gonna play and I can't wait, and then to have another guy say I'm with them, and you know, and builds from there, it's great.
Nick, we're gonna let you run. Appreciate your time. Thanks so much. Go get them. Thanks,
Nick.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, thanks.
Take care.
So yeah,
Nick Nurse, head coach of the Toronto Raptors, and Orlando Magic tomorrow night on. He looks at his sheet, Sportsnet Ontario and Sportsnet One.
By the way, if you're Nick Nurse. And again, his main job is the Raptors, and I understand that. And maybe he knew beforehand, but if he didn't, and like just people letting you know, hey, Nick, come over here for a second. Here's what Jamal Murray just said. Hey, Nick, come over here for a second. I mean, you got to feel good. Like he's an excellent coach, and now he has the talent to match his coaching, which is going to be great.
So there you go. It's interesting. Hearing his comments about that bench group in particular,
and he's got some interesting decisions coming up when Kyle and Serge come back, I had no idea
about the sort of going to two-a-days after he'd called out Rondae Hollis-Jefferson. And but again, that's the thing that about this bench unit, about these guys that I found so amazing, is just the fact that they've been able to do so much offensively. Because I said guys can come off the bench and work their ass off and give you good defense and be gritty and all that good stuff. Yeah. But it's when you get the ball. What do you do when you get the ball that I think separates good?
Boucher is much better offensively, Jeff, this year, like significantly than last year. And Terrence Davis is just a revelation.
I love what Nick said.
That's a first-round pick basically falling in your lap.
Absolutely. I like what Nick said about Chris Boucher. He hasn't seen a shot. He doesn't like it in about 3 years.
He does. Green
light. Explains a lot. Absolutely. That's it for us again. We'll be back as normal tomorrow. We'll be on 360 from 3:30 to 5. The hockey game is on. Something like that. We're on 360 from 2 to 5. The hockey game is on here at 3:30. Puck drop at 4 o'clock. I'll get it right eventually. Something like that. Have a great night. Tim and Sid are next.